Good day, and welcome to today's Ready or Not 2010 conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I will turn the conference over to Mr. Jeff Levy. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Levy. I'm Executive Director of the Trust for America's Health. Thank you for joining us today for the release of our annual report, Ready or Not, Protecting the Public's Health from Diseases, Disasters, and Bioterrorism. The report is being released by Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. A copy of the full report, including state-specific information, is on our website at www.healthyamericans.org. I'm honored to be joined today by Jim Blumenstock, who is the Chief Program Officer for Public Health Practice of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and we're hoping to be joined by Robert Pestronk, who is Executive Director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. I'll start the call with an overview of key findings from the report, then Jim Blumenstock will provide comments from the state's perspective, and then Bobby Pestronk will talk about the impact of budget cuts on preparedness at the local level. I'll close with some recommendations from the report, and then we'll open up the call for questions. For the past 8 years, in the Ready or Not report, we've looked at how well the nation's public health system is prepared to respond to disease outbreaks, natural disasters, or acts of bioterrorism. Each year, we develop 10 key indicators to assess health emergency preparedness capabilities in states. These indicators reflect some important areas of preparedness, which, taken together, offer a composite snapshot of strengths and vulnerabilities in the nation's preparedness. It is not a comprehensive analysis, but we feel it is important to conduct this report each year because we believe that the public deserves to know how prepared their states and communities are to respond to public health emergencies. Federal and state governments only release limited current specific data about the status of emergency preparedness. We believe that all Americans have the right to expect fundamental health protections during public health emergencies, no matter where they live, and our report helps identify both the areas of strength as well as weakness that should be addressed in our nation's capabilities. In this year's Ready or Not, overall, the states had the highest scores ever for health emergency preparedness. More than three-quarters of the states scored a 7 or higher. 14 states of those that score, excuse me, more than three-quarters of the states scored 7 or higher. 14 of those states scored 9 or higher. Three states, Arkansas, North Dakota, and Washington State, scored 10 out of 10. No state scored lower than a 5. These scores reflect nearly 10 years of progress to improve how the nation prevents, identifies, and contains new disease outbreaks and bioterrorism threats, and responds to the aftermath of natural disasters in the wake of September 11th and the anthrax tragedies. In addition, the real-world experience responding to the H1N1 flu pandemic, supported by emergency supplemental funding, also helped bring preparedness to the next level. But as we find in this report, the Great Recession is taking its toll on emergency health preparedness. Nearly a decade of gains are in real jeopardy due to severe budget cuts at the federal, state, and local level. In this year's report, we found that 33 states and Washington, D.C. cut funding for public health last year. For 18 states, this was the second year in a row of cuts. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has found that states have experienced overall budgetary shortfalls of $425 billion since fiscal 2009. And almost all states have started the current fiscal year with a projected deficit. So far, some of the cuts to public health have not yet affected public health as dramatically as in some other sectors due to various one-time funding streams, including the supplemental funding provided by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and emergency funding for the H1N1 response. But now the cuts are really hitting home. Jim and Bobby will talk more about the impact of budget cuts on state and local preparedness, but I wanted to emphasize it now also because the potential impact of these cuts cannot be overstated. The combined federal, state, and local cuts constitute an emergency for emergency health preparedness in the United States. Some of the other key findings from the report are, on a measure looking at how prepared we are to protect vulnerable members of communities, half of states do not mandate all licensed child care facilities to have a multi-hazard written evacuation and relocation plan. This is based on analysis by the Save the Children organization. On a measure about the ability to rapidly identify new threats, 10 states do not have an electronic syndromic surveillance system that can report and exchange information. 7 state public health departments cannot currently share data electronically with healthcare providers, and 4 states do not have sufficient capacity to work 5 12-hour days for 6 to 8 weeks in response to an infectious disease. disease outbreak, such as H1N1. We also included information available for the first time from CDC about some key emergency operations capabilities. The data from 2007-2008 but are the most timely information available and show that nearly all the states met the outlined CDC target goals for key activities, such as activating their emergency operations centers a minimum of twice during the year. Most were able to acknowledge notification of a new threat or incident within a target time of 60 minutes at least twice during the year, and only two states did not develop at least two after-action reports within 60 days of a real incident or test exercise. The CDC also found, however, on a food safety measure, that 21 states were not able to rapidly identify disease-causing E. coli and submit the lab results in 90% of cases within 4 days during 2007-2008. CDC is going to be releasing a new food safety report shortly, and what is clear over the years is that food safety is a significant and ongoing point of vulnerability in our public health system. I'm sure many of you are following legislation currently making its final way through the Congress, and this would be the first major attempt to update the food safety system in a century. Overall, while the report documents progress, it also identifies a series of major ongoing gaps in preparedness, including gaps in basic infrastructure and funding, biosurveillance, maintaining an adequate and expertly trained workforce, developing and manufacturing vaccines and medicines, surge capacity for providing care in major emergencies, and helping communities cope with and recover from emergencies. I'll address some of the recommendations for these concerns at the end of the call. But now I'd like to turn the call over to Jim Blumenstock, who's Chief Program Officer for Public Health Practice of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Jim?
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning, everybody. I truly am pleased to be with you this morning and to be part of today's very important program. The Ready or Not report represents a time each year really to reflect on public health preparedness in the United States. After the September 11th and anthrax attacks, it's hard to believe that's nearly 10 years ago, it became clear that the public health system really needed to be modernized to face today's and tomorrow's threats and challenges. Since then, state and local health departments around the country have been working tirelessly to develop strategies, build capacity and capabilities, and update their systems so we can be prepared for the range of possible threats. Obviously, it's quite challenging to be fully prepared for every scenario in every jurisdiction, but it's essential to maintain a necessary core level of preparation and response capabilities nationwide. Protecting the public from health threats is a major priority for states, and it is taken very seriously. We're proud of the tremendous progress the hardworking public health professionals have made to protect the communities around the country. The public health system and the public health practitioners are breaking new ground, and new issues emerge for preparedness daily. If you reflect upon just the last 12 months, we faced such things as the H1N1 influenza pandemic, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf Coast that affected a concern of not only recreational waters but seafood safety, foodborne illness, some of national proportion, a range of natural disasters both in the homeland and elsewhere, such as helping with international relief efforts for the earthquake and the cholera outbreak in Haiti, and along with a host of other public health emergencies and events. Developing a set of valid performance measures for preparedness is not a simple process. The Ready or Not report contributes to a growing set of efforts to develop and improve measures with accountability and transparency, and as Jeff said, is not a comprehensive analysis, nor are they exhaustive, but it's a snapshot of key issues. The report is one of a number of ways to help us keep an eye on our progress over the years. This progress was particularly evident last year during the H1N1 pandemic. The outbreak response showed that the country was much better prepared to respond to a pandemic than it would have been just a few short years ago. There was an unprecedented large-scale nationwide public health response that involved many pieces: surveillance, laboratory testing, public and practitioner education, medical countermeasures management, such as the distribution of antivirals, and the distribution and the launch of the national vaccination campaign. In such a short period of time, a vaccine was developed, and more than 80 million Americans were vaccinated against H1N1 flu last year, which exceeded 25% of the nation's population. In addition, last year, seasonal flu vaccinations reached a historic high, with 40% of adults and children ages 6 months to 17 years old receiving the seasonal flu vaccine. So again, two nationwide flu campaigns during the same season. This is just one vivid demonstration that the investment in public health preparedness pays off. In addition, the indicators in the report from my association, ASTO, and the CDC show that nearly every state met the goals for some key response areas around notifying emergency staff quickly, maintaining emergency operation centers, being able to share information electronically between health departments and healthcare providers, and maintaining syndromic surveillance systems that can report and exchange information in a timely fashion. A number of the issues discussed in the report also go beyond the scope of a public health department, such as the ability of the total healthcare system to care for a mass influx of patients during a major emergency, or the research and development of up-to-date vaccines and medicines, or the ability to improve systems to reach and provide support for the most vulnerable members of our community during emergencies. These two are important national concerns and must have federal support and leadership to advance, and we must continue our work together in these areas. As Jeff alluded to, cuts in federal support to public health preparedness, which is also discussed in the report, are of great concern to the states and are putting nearly a decade of gains at risk, especially at a time when states are trying to cope with daunting and formidable budget shortfalls of their own. We cannot jeopardize important areas of preparedness by further cutting federal funds for preparedness. Base federal support for public health preparedness has been cut 27% since fiscal year 2005, adjusting for inflation. This year, it was proposed that federal preparedness support be cut another $184 million for FY 2011. It didn't happen, though, when it was recognized that this would hurt emergency readiness, that as we are facing a tough economic climate, these funds could be at risk again. It is generally recognized that public health has been underfunded for decades, which means we haven't had all of the resources we need to prepare for emergencies on an ongoing basis or to respond when an emergency happens. If we're going to be able to adequately protect people, the country needs to invest in emergency health preparedness in a sustainable way. Public health departments are stretched thin. We are losing many of our talented and trained public health professionals. There are tens of thousands fewer public health jobs in this country than there were 20 years ago, and one-third of the current public health workforce will be eligible to retire within 5 years as baby boomers become eligible to retire. Cuts in federal funding means reductions in equipment, resources, the workforce development programs and features, as well as overall capabilities. In closing, I want to again stress that even in the times of fiscal difficulties, your country's public health system stands at the ready to respond as swiftly and effectively as possible to protect their communities. We need to ensure that they have adequate resources to protect the public from the range of threats we face. And while government leaders face difficult budget decisions, it is vital to protect and provide sufficient federal funds for these public health preparedness programs. These are essential services that the citizens of our state rely on public health officials for, and we must be able to deliver them even in hard times. So, Jeff, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'll turn the program back to you.
Thanks, Jim. And now I will turn the call over to Robert Pestronk, who is Executive Director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Bobby?
Thank you, Jeff and Jim. At the National Association, we've been tracking the impact of budget cuts on local health departments for several years. Since 2008, approximately 15% of the local public health workforce, the boots on the ground, public health officials in the 2,700 county and city health departments across the country have been cut. These are also our neighbors and our friends. Many state and local governments are also instituting hiring freezes, as we've discovered, along with mandatory furlough days or shortened work weeks. And through 2009, reduced hours or required furloughs have affected 13,000 additional public health workers. Many departments, local health departments, are being forced to cut programs and vital services. For instance, 13% of local health departments made cuts to immunization programs. 9% have reduced their core capacity to detect and analyze threats to the public's health. And 7% have made cuts directly to their emergency preparedness programs. Nearly three-quarters of the U.S. population, 73%, live in a jurisdiction of a local health department that lost staff between June and December 2009. And with a median size in local health departments of 18 staff, one begins to understand the significance of the loss of even one staff and the effect on response capability. Our early surveillance for 2010 is that there will be additional losses in local health departments. Economic stress is still high in many states and localities, and some are feeling this stress for the first time. So while Jeff mentioned that the cuts have been hitting home and getting more drastic to public health, some of the impact of the budget cuts are only just now beginning to be felt, and especially because there's no longer funding from the Recovery Act or emergency support for H1N1 response, and because local revenue projections continually are being dropped as the revenues for those localities come in, and these are forcing even more cutbacks. The real problem is that we're now left in a situation where many health departments don't have enough resources or staff to manage ongoing day-to-day operations, and it leaves all of us vulnerable to the next public health emergency. It's clear that we respond to crises at the moment, but our country is not particularly good at responding on an ongoing basis to provide the emergency response funding, the foundation funding, and the resources that we need on an ongoing basis. And these vulnerabilities are only made worse in the economic climate that we're all facing today. The Band-Aid approach to preparedness really needs to change, because without a consistent strategy, it's hard to respond to outbreaks like the pandemics that have been referred to or acts of bioterrorism. We need to have a workplace and resources in place, not being developed at the time that the emergency strikes. The foundation of public health is, in fact, crumbling. And to use an analogy, the way in which we're funding local health departments would be equivalent to funding fire departments after fires have already started and waiting to see whether we have the workforce and the trucks to respond. Homes and businesses would be burned down with that kind of funding philosophy. We need to maintain the professionals and the resources and the connections and the partnerships in the public health system so the country is protected at all times, regardless of what the threat is. Preparedness isn't just for emergency and disasters. The cuts undermine the ability to assure safe food in restaurants, to respond to regular outbreaks of disease, and to organize efforts to create the conditions in which people can be healthy, in which they won't need to get fixed because they won't be broken in the first place, and where health will be the easy, the default choice. One of the areas that Ready or Not report covers, which requires constant investment and attention and is at risk for cuts, is developing community resiliency. This means ensuring that communities can cope with and recover from emergencies. Building communities is one of the overarching goals of the recent draft plan of the National Health Security Strategy. At NACHO, we represent every type of community and locality from coast to coast, small and large. And public health professionals are first responders. They are the army of silent guardians, the witnesses to every type of disaster, and the responders to disasters as well, as important as other first responders. And we're seeing the immediate impact of disasters on communities nationwide and the long-term effects of emergencies, including the mental health stress and ongoing health concerns that develop from emergencies like September 11th, Hurricane Katrina, the Gulf Coast oil spill, and a range of natural and, frankly, economic disasters. One final point I'd like to give special emphasis to is the need to protect the more vulnerable members of our communities, including children, the uninsured and the underinsured, the elderly, people with underlying health conditions, and racial and ethnic minorities. There are special strategies needed to be certain that in an emergency they receive the same attention that everyone else receives. And with resources diminishing in local communities nationwide, the capacity for that is also diminishing. With additional resources, local health departments can work with communities. They can provide clear, straightforward guidance and develop standing relationships with people, with neighborhoods, with businesses, and with other organizations in their community so that when an emergency happens, everyone will know what to do. The instructions will be trusted and understood. Unless local public health departments get the support needed, we're all at risk of leaving members of our community to fend for themselves just at the time when they'll need the support the most. Jeff, let me turn it back to you.
Thanks, Bobby. I'd like to wrap up with some of the high-level recommendations featured in the report. The report goes into more detail on each one, but some recommendations for addressing the ongoing major gaps in emergency health preparedness include addressing gaps in funding and infrastructure. We must provide adequate resources to truly modernize the public health system to bring it into the 21st century. The Affordable Care Act provides a new opportunity for increased funding to improve infrastructure, and in fact, in fiscal 2010, we saw an initial payment of $70 million in one-time funding to build that infrastructure. That is critical for our ability to respond to all kinds of health emergencies, including the kind that we talk about in this report. If these efforts are coordinated, the funds that are available under the Affordable Care Act can really improve our modernize our response to in the preparedness realm. We also need to address a gap in disease surveillance. The U.S. lacks an integrated national approach to biosurveillance, and there are major variations in how quickly states collect and report data, which hamper bioterrorism and disease outbreak response capabilities. This is obviously one of the areas that must be a priority for modernization, and with the advent of electronic health records and health information technology, there's a tremendous opportunity to rethink how we do surveillance. We also need to address gaps in vaccine and pharmaceutical research development and production. We recommend strategic rethinking to strengthen the research, development, and production of medical countermeasures. A recently released plan from the White House and Department of Health and Human Services would address key priorities to spark innovation and create incentives for industry while protecting the public's interest. That plan needs to be implemented, it needs to be fleshed out, and above all, it needs to be funded. The response that we saw around H1N1 was limited in part by the time it took to develop diagnostics and the time it took by the kind of diagnostics we had and the time it took to develop a vaccine. We have the capacity to do better if we invest in it. We also need to address gaps in surge capacity. The challenge of how to equip and train the healthcare system to handle a large number of critically injured or ill patients during emergencies remains the most challenging issue for public health and medical preparedness. TIFA supports efforts by the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at HHS to reassess the current hospital preparedness program, and we continue to support efforts from groups ranging from the Institute of Medicine to associations of health professionals to create and improve surge capacity strategies and practices. And finally, we need to address gaps in community resiliency support. As Bobby mentioned, preparing communities to respond to and cope with emergencies is an ongoing challenge. We particularly need to develop strategies for maintaining relationships with hard-to-reach and at-risk communities. TIFA supports recommendations from the National Commission on Children and Disasters and from the National Consensus Panel of the U.S. Department of Health and Services, Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health, which range from creating drills that incorporate specific scenarios around diversity, culture, language, and trust, and building capacity of culturally and linguistically appropriate services and programs. In closing, we have a long way to go to optimally be prepared to respond to health emergencies in the United States. However, as this report shows, serious progress has been made, but it requires effort and resources to make it happen. We've come a long way, and it could have tragic consequences if we start to backslide. With that, operator will now open up the call for questions, and I'd like to remind everyone that the report and state-by-state indicators are available, and as well as individual state news releases, are available at our website, www.healthyamericans.org. Thanks.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. To ask a question, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. We'll take as many questions as time permits and proceed in order that you signal us. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask a question. Please state your name before posing your question, and once again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause a moment to assemble the queue. And we'll take our first question.
Okay.
Hi, this is Jeff Young calling from Bloomberg News. The report, and you mentioned this as well, says that 33 states and the District of Columbia cut their funding for public health between the fiscal years 08 through 2010. Do you have a tally of what the spending was in the latter period compared to the beginning of the time that you're measuring?
We do not have a dollar figure. Unfortunately, we do not have a dollar figure. This was sort of a yes-no question,
okay.
So we're not able to calculate what the change was. I do have to say that, you know, this was a point-in-time study, and my guess is, you know, a month or two from now, as state legislatures come back, this might be a grimmer picture.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, it is star one, and we'll take our next question.
Oh, hi, I was just wondering if you guys had more recommendations specific to each state.
No, we do not make recommendations that are state-specific, other than for those states that have not, you know, obviously met this indicator, that would be certainly an area to focus on.
Okay, and no elaboration on the point ratings for each state either, then?
In what sense?
You know, these charts are yes or no.
Correct.
And there's no kind of remarks beyond the yes or no.
Right, we do explain
okay.
what the indicator means, but no, there is nothing more
specific
about
okay,
how,
got it.
What, right, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star one. And we'll take our next question.
Hi, this is Bob Rose with FIDRAP News. I had a question for Mr. Pestronk. You mentioned the gave some figures on the cuts made by local health departments. I think you said 13% made cuts in immunization and 9% in reducing, or 9% reduced core capacity to detect and analyze threats. And you mentioned another percentage about, I think, direct cuts in emergency preparedness. Could you tell me what that percentage was, and can you say a little bit more about the about what these cuts mean, for example, on a 9% cut in reducing core capacity, what kinds of jobs or what exactly that means?
Sure. The number for cuts made directly to emergency preparedness programs was 7%. What the capacity, what the cuts in immunization programs mean is that there are fewer staff to actually put shots in people's arms or to organize both ahead of time and during emergency the kinds of information and medical campaigns that would be necessary to vaccinate people in communities, as we saw done so successfully and as reported by Jeff and Jim earlier in the call during the H1N1 outbreak, during which in a very short period of time community efforts were mobilized to vaccinate the highest number of people for flu. The cuts, the 9% cuts that have been made to in areas to detect and analyze threats to health mean that local health departments on a day-to-day basis in nearly every community across the country are capturing information from a variety of sources about the range of day-to-day chronic and communicable disease threats, injuries, and other community characteristics which influence the health of people in communities and populations of whole communities. And the staff that perform that work, the information technology structure that's necessary to capture and analyze those data on a community-wide basis are, in fact, being lost. And with respect to the emergency preparedness programs, the response to any kind of an emergency is an individual response, often requiring the development both of plans ahead of time and the actualization or operationalization of those plans at the time of an emergency. As I think has been said in the military, of course, at the time the actual event happens, the plans have to be modified. The loss of staff in the emergency preparedness programs mean that the very people who've been who've planned and who have trained and who have exercised at the time of an event and who are familiar with the people and organizational resources and financial resources that are available both in their communities, in their states, and at the federal level are no longer available in the health department to help plan, train, exercise, and organize for that response, and then to be part of the community response during a disaster and to help with the resiliency that's required during and after a disaster as well.
Thank you.
The lessons actually that have been learned through planning and training and exercising for disasters and emergencies also have application to the day-to-day work in local health departments and in communities. The kinds of contacts and relationships that have been made with neighborhoods, with hospitals, with physicians, with media, with others, serve local health departments and their communities and the people in communities well. So the loss of those people results not only in the loss of capacity to identify and respond and recover during an emergency, but also the loss of the capacity to make use of those same competencies and skills on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you.
This is Cindy Yukon from the Billings Gazette in Billings, Montana. So much of the report, question is for Jeff. So much of the report talks about the cuts to public funding and you know, the impact and the devastation that that's had. Montana is one of actually, I think, 17 states, you know, where we did not cut public funding, but yet we're last. What does that mean for those of us living here and really what, I mean, we're dead last. What does it mean for our residents? Does it mean we're not safe in a healthy in a health emergency?
Well, I you know, some of it depends on what the nature of the health emergency is. But you know, frankly, if you're at the lower end of the scores, it is of some concern. But as we point out in the report, these are 10 indicators that are not an overall scorecard of the absolute level of preparedness. It is looking at 10 elements that make up a part of preparedness about which there are data and about which there ought to be sort of a standardized response across the nation. So these are clearly areas of weakness. Now, the funding issue is not just one about state budgets, but it is also one about federal funding. And it's very hard, as both Bobby and Jim have pointed out, to maintain your capacity when there are fluctuations in federal funding. The overall commitment to preparedness funding has declined over the last few years from the federal government. In a sense, surge money was provided during the H1N1 pandemic that helped to fill some gaps. But that's not a way to run a railroad, as you know, people used to say, because it doesn't give the consistency of funding that allows the core capacity to be developed, and in fact, that allows a jurisdiction to start addressing some of the deficiencies that are mentioned in this report. So, if you're not able to rapidly turn around disease, you know, foodborne disease detection, that's an ongoing capacity. That's not something that you can resolve with some surge capacity once there's a food outbreak. Jim or Bobby, do you want to add?
Sure. This is Jim Blumenstock from ASTO. The main point I'd like to share is I would not want any of your readers or listeners to draw the conclusion that they are at increased risk because they live in a state that got less than a perfect score. And I say that with a great deal of confidence and passion for a couple of reasons, not only because of what Jeff has described, that this is just 10 of what could be hundreds of different indicators given the depth and breadth of overall preparedness. But there are a couple of other points that you also need to realize. It's just sort of the nature of the beast when you do these types of reporting processes. Number one, simply people out of the state did not get a point for an indicator or a category. It doesn't mean that they don't have some significant level of capacity and capability in that area. What it means is they just didn't meet the full test of the scoring process to get a point or not get a point. So again, it doesn't mean that they're totally void of that capability or capacity. And then the second point is that this is an evolving and enduring process. So, you know, looking at this 90 days from now, in many cases, you would find improvements being made, whether it be in planning or in response to a real event where they've done after action and continuous improvement processes. So, you know, those are sort of the three caveats that we want to share, that the report has use, it has value, but it should not be overinterpreted for anyone to glean an impression that they are at any increased risk in any jurisdiction.
Jim, I appreciate that very much.
This is Bobby. I would just say, generally speaking, that public health and governmental public health work at the local, state, and federal level is in the business of preventing things from happening in the first place, and the only real test to know who's at risk is a disaster or the day-to-day events that are taking place in a local community or in any state. And I don't think any of us wants to wait to discover who is at highest risk in any state or in any locality when we know the kinds of resources and the kinds of people and the kinds of processes and steps that are necessary in any state to reduce risk.
One. And we'll take a follow-up from.
Yes, this is Bob Rose with SIDRAP News. Thanks for taking another question. This is a little outside the scope of the report, but you mentioned the food safety legislation. I wonder if you can give us an update on that at this point, and what your assessment is of the chances of it actually getting through before Congress adjourns.
Well, legislation was essentially passed by both houses, and there's just, you know, the food safety bill, as passed by the Senate, was incorporated into the continuing resolution passed by the House. So, in effect, the language in the Senate passed bill has now been passed by both houses. The continuing resolution is now in front of the Senate, and whether it's in the form of a continuing resolution or an omnibus appropriations bill for the entire fiscal year, it's everyone's anticipation that the food safety bill will be part of that. And that will then make a dramatic difference in terms of the capacity of the Food and Drug Administration in particular to do proactive prevention of food safety problems rather than focusing on responding after the fact.
Okay, thank you.
There are implications there. This is Bobby. Implications there also for local and training and consistency in application of food safety practices across the country. Well, so we're hopeful at the local level that as Jeff has said, that it will be passed.
Thank you.
It appears there are no further questions at this time. Mr. Levy, I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Again, I'd like to thank both Jim Blumenstock and Bobby Vestrong for joining me today, and the materials for the report, both the full report and state-by-state materials, are available at our website, healthyamericans.org. Thank you all for joining us.
And that does conclude.